most interesting guests in the music industry, entertainment, art, and politics step into the studio for Turning Point with Frank McKay. And now, Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Welcome to Turning Point. Our very special guest today is actress Candy Clark. Candy, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
A lot of people know Candy from her work in American Graffiti and The Man Who Fell from Earth.
The Man Who Fell to Earth.
I'm sorry.
Hard to fall from Earth.
Yeah, right. I'm sure I'm not the first to make that mistake.
No, you're not.
And that was with David Bowie.
Think about it. Yeah, it was. It was with David Bowie and Buck Henry and Rip Torn.
Yeah, what was that like? What was it like working with Bowie?
It was really good. I'm so grateful that I hadn't seen him in concert before we started working together, because I would have been totally, you know, intimidated. But since I had never seen him in concert, he was just like another actor to me. And we worked together really well. He liked to rehearse. He liked to run the lines, you know, and I attribute that to him being a musician. You know, they're always rehearsing and they think nothing of it. So we had a really good relationship, and it was a great script with an excellent director, Nick Rogue. And we shot in New Mexico, and that's a really pretty state. And it was just a lot of fun, and David Bowie was great.
How about Buck Henry? What was he like to work with?
Did I have many scenes with him? Yeah, I had like one scene where he's trying to get me to sign off on something regarding The Man Who Fell to Earth, and I clear his desk, you know, with my hands, lamps, everything goes flying. Because I miss my Tommy. But, you know, it was easy.
Yeah.
Most actors are very easy to work with. You know, they just want to do a good job.
Well, when you did your work with American Graffiti, and for American Graffiti, it culminated in an Academy Award nomination, and that's got to be exciting at any point.
That was thrilling. But I never expected to win. I went there with no speech. And I thought that Sylvia Sidney was going to win for Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams, because she had been around the longest. And a lot of times you feel like that they'll give you an Academy Award for sentimental reasons because you never gave up, and there you're still there. And that year, Tatum O'Neill won, the youngest,
yeah,
a 9-year-old. That was a real surprise and a shock for all of us, I think. She won for Paper Moon.
Was that a surprise?
Yes, it was a total surprise.
Well, she did an excellent job in the movie, actually.
I know, but I think she was in the wrong category. She should have been in Best Actress instead of Best Supporting Actress, because she was really a lead character.
Yeah, but that was your first experience with the Academy Awards, right?
Yes, and it was fantastic. I had never been... patted on the back, hugged. I got telegrams. That's when they used to have telegrams. And even from Lou Wasserman, I was digging through some old stuff
Wow.
a month or two ago, and there was a telegram from Lou Wasserman, the head of Universal Studios.
My God. Oh, that must
I know.
And you figure this is going to last forever.
Oh, of course. You always think that. Well, if someone does, no one wants to bust your bubble and say, this is not going to last forever.
We're speaking with actress Candy Clark, and we're talking a little bit about the business, but certainly about her career. And you've had a wonderful career. How many movies all totaled?
Oh, over 50 movies and television things.
Is there anything that we've never seen you in, or you assume that people never saw you in that you wish they would have?
Well, most of my stuff was really, you know, released through a studio. So most of it was seen in one way, you know, how many people, we don't know, but you know, most of it was seen.
Let me word.
There's a lot of, you know, yes, word it another way.
Let me word it another way. Is there anything that you thought was just so wonderful, you know, it put together a great movie, and that you on the acting end and the director and the production, they did their job, but the theater didn't, well, not the theater, the movie studio didn't in promoting it?
Well, I would say that The Man Who Fell to Earth really got ruined by the American distributor. It had come out in Europe, the full uncut version, and that was 2 hours and 23 minutes, and it was going to be distributed by a company called Cinema 5, which was had a real high-end reputation, kind of like Harvey Weinstein's company. What's the name of that company? Anyway, the owner of the company thought, you know, when he saw the film, he edited it down to 2 hours, and it was a dismal flop for years. Nobody saw it, and I was so disappointed. I was going to go on the road for The Man Who Fell to Earth and travel around the country and be on a two-week tour to promote it, but once I saw how they had chopped it up and taken out 23 minutes just willy-nilly, they had hired this editor that did commercials, you know, like for Kraft macaroni and cheese and that kind of thing. And he just, you know, in a few days just edited the film down to a two-hour version. And it had taken Nick Rogue over a year to edit, you know, painstakingly, slowly, but he had a beautiful film and a classic. And, you know, many years later, I was thinking about The Man Who Fell to Earth. I was living in New Jersey at the time, and I heard that the owner of the company was gone. So I called the new person that was in charge of distribution. And I gave him a pitch. I said, you know, you don't have to make a new poster. You just put a banner across and say, uncut director's version. And I said, I'll do whatever it takes to promote it, radio, television. I'll go on the road for it. And
What year was that?
Oh, God. I think somewhere in the 90s. I'm not sure.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I cut you
anyway,
off.
So... he calls back, you know, we have a good relationship. He calls back and he says, well, you know, bad news. Our negative has been all cut up. The guy cut the negative, too.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and so I said, well, I know where the negative is. And, you know, it's in London, England, and here's the name of the company, and here's the people to ask for. And so that's what he did, and... the rest is history. It came out. It was in New York City. That's where it started. And slowly but surely, the copies of the chopped-up version of The Man Who Fell to Earth disappeared and was replaced by the full version. And now Criterion has put it out. And, you know, it's unfortunate, because I was really relying on that film and my work to kind of catapult me to, you know, more work, and I was going to run an Academy Award campaign, but,
yeah,
you know, with it all chopped up, nobody could make heads or tails of the film. If you ever see the uncut version, it is really hard to follow.
Yeah. We're with Candy Clark. We're with actress Candy Clark. Candy, how did it do in England?
Oh, it did well. You know, David Bowie's from England, and you know, it's always been ahead of its time, but now, you know, people are catching up, especially now that it's the full version, the director's cut is out. You can, you know, it's a complicated film, and it's going, you know, around in time, you know, the actors age, The Man Who Fell to Earth doesn't age. And so it's, you know, you really have to pay attention. It's beautifully shot by Tony Richmond, so there's a lot of gorgeous, you know, frames in that film. And I thought David Bowie was just at the height of his beauty and his handsomeness, and also he was perfect as the the man from another planet. He looked like he was from another planet.
And some people would say
the red hair and the blonde streak.
Yeah, some people would say he was perfectly cast for that.
He was perfectly cast for that.
Yeah,
perfectly cast. You couldn't ask for a more perfect actor, and I thought he did a fantastic job. You know, it was a lot of work. We had to wear a lot of appliances and age and, you know, all that stuff. You get stuck on your face, that rubber stuff that's supposed to age you and make you look old.
Yeah.
That takes hours to put on.
We are with Candy Clark, actress Candy Clark, Academy Award winning. No, I'm sorry, Academy Award nominated for her work in American Graffiti. She should have won, but that bitch, Tatum O'Neill. No. I'm just kidding. But I think, you know, a lot of people, those two movies that we're talking about have...
Oh, my gosh, what?
Those two movies that we've been talking about...
Yes.
...have a cult following to both of them. A Man Who Fell to Earth certainly has a bit of a cult following. And
it does.
And we can't ignore that. American Graffiti, I mean, completely, but certainly more mainstream. But those two movies came around a time, and again, I'm 45 now, so I mean, when cable television came out, there wasn't such a glut of movies that, for example, HBO, I think, was the one channel, you know, the one station, and they were just playing those movies over and over and over again. And, you know, American Graffiti, more than anything, it was on constantly. I mean, constantly.
It still is.
Yeah. No doubt about it. I'm sure
the thing lives on television. It really does.
Yeah, and it stands up. I mean, it's good.
It does. It really stands up. And I've met people that have seen it thousands of times.
Yeah.
Jeff Beck, you know, the guitarist.
Yep.
3,000 times he told me.
That's amazing.
Because he wanted to replicate the car. Plus, he's graffiti mad, and he built a car. Exactly like the yellow five-window coupe.
Who else has walked up to you about that movie? Let's talk specifically about American Graffiti. Who has walked up to you that threw you for a loop and said, I love your work in there. I love that movie. You mentioned Jeff Beck. Who else stands out?
Oh, millions of people. I've done a lot of hot rod shows. I've traveled to Sweden twice. I've gone to Japan. I've gone across the U.S., I've been doing hot rod shows since like 1999, and just millions of people, and they'll get teary-eyed about it, talking about how they took their wife, you know, who was the girlfriend at the time, to the movie, and now they've been married for, you know, 40 years, and, you know, they've built their car. They got into the pinstriping business because of American Graffiti. They started collecting hot rods and collector cars because of them. They got their shop, their custom shop, because of American Graffiti. All of those oldies, George, you know, the music, George Lucas got all of those songs, 41 songs, for $40,000.
Oh,
so that's
gosh.
Like $1,000 a piece. And at that time, those artists, those musicians, their careers were pretty well, you know, over with. It was the Beatles, it was disco, you know, oldies was passe. But it really worked in the film, and it revived so many of those musicians' careers, and their groups got back together, and they started doing shows at fairgrounds, and, you know, it just rebuilt the whole their whole careers. And so I and a lot of people owe their livelihoods to American Graffiti.
We mentioned George, you just mentioned George Lucas.
I did.
And again, we're with actress Candy Clark, and talking about American Graffiti, what was it like? Well, what was he like at that point, George Lucas? What was your impression of him?
He's very, 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 very quiet, introverted. You know, he's I think he never really enjoyed directing, and that's why he went more into, you know, other people directing his stuff, and he just, you know, edits. That's what he likes to do. You know, I never thought he'd be a billionaire, if that's what you want to know. He's the one that got the idea to make the toys, you know, for Star Wars. And to this day, I was over at Target buying cat food a week or two ago. There's a whole aisle to this day devoted to Star Wars toys.
It's amazing.
To this day.
It's amazing. Just absolutely.
It is amazing.
Do you remember any of the direction he gave you?
You know, he hired people that he thought could do the job, and so we would rehearse the scene. It was a low budget film, and I think all total the cost, you know, including the music, was $850,000. That includes editing, music, you know, hiring the actors, location. We shot in Petaluma, California. We didn't have much in the way of equipment or dressing rooms. We had no chairs. You know, if you wanted to sit down, you had to sit on the curb or sit in one of the cars. It was very basic, and we shot at night. We shot in Petaluma, California, and that summer it was so foggy and so cold. It was about, I don't know, 50 degrees at night, maybe less, and we're supposed to be acting like it's a hot summer's evening, and, you know, and it all took place in one night. The whole idea was very unique, and, you know, with the interaction of the multitude of stories plus the music interweaving, kind of building the stories and adding to the scenes, you know, George was quiet. He didn't say much, but he mostly talked to Haskell Wexler, his cinematographer. And as the movie went on, he got thinner and thinner and quieter because in the day he was editing and at night he was shooting. So he was working nonstop day and night. And, you know, it was very pleasant to be with. He wasn't yelling at anyone, but he was, you know, kind of there, but not there.
Candy Clark, actress Candy Clark, is talking about her career and certainly American Graffiti. And the launch pad that movie served as, you know, you mentioned George Lucas being a billionaire. If Ron Howard's not a billionaire, he's certainly on his way to being a billionaire.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. What was your impression of him?
Well, he was one of our true teenagers at the time, and the rest of us were older. He had a little film that he had shot with his brother as the main actor, and he had entered a Kodak film contest for student filmmakers, and he had won second prize. And he brought he told me about it, and he had a little viewer thing where you put your eyes up and then you hand crank it. And I watched the film, and it was really good. And I said, Ronnie, you're going to be a big director one day. And he wanted me to be in this film called Eat My Dust. And
is that Roger Corman?
Yes, he directed that. And I was supposed to be his romantic interest, and I turned him down. And he never asked me to do another thing again. So I guess he's still miffed about that.
Why did you turn him down?
Because I didn't like the script.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, you would have done it like the script or not.
Well, who has, you know, 20/20 hindsight?
Right, of course.
There's a lot of things that I would have done that I didn't, like buy gold when it was $45 an ounce.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to look back on stuff. Well, I would have done it different, but, you know, who knew at the time?
Let's talk about your career prior to American Graffiti. How many films or how much work did you do prior to?
Well, I had been in one film called Fat City, directed by John Huston.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I started at the top.
Yeah. You're not kidding.
And that was great. That was with Jeff Bridges and Stacy Keach, Susan Terrell. and John Huston directing, Ray Stark producing, and it was, you know, just fantastic. We shot it up in Stockton, California, 2 months in Stockton, and we stayed at the Holiday Inn, which was next door to the Civic Center, and you know, the Civic Center offered boxing, roller derby, and salsa dancing, and it was a lot of fun.
Actress Candy Clark is our special guest today on Turning Point.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Actress Candy Clark is our special guest today on Turning Point. How did you get into acting in the first place? Well, let's start from the beginning. Where did you grow up, and how did you get into
acting? I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm the oldest of five. I have four brothers. And that's where I grew up.
And did you do...
We were very... we didn't have any money, and at that time, they didn't have social network that could help you. They didn't have all of that stuff that they have today. So we really struggled.
Were you a two-parent home?
No. Just my mother and the five kids. My dad was an alcoholic. And so, you know, he was there in body but not in spirit. He left when I was 12 and moved to San Jose, California. He was a chef. And a really good one. He was a good cook.
Did you have a relationship with him afterwards? Or was that it?
I did. I was the only one that really spoke to him. My brothers had no relationship with him. And he would always call and say, I'm going to come down there and, you know, straighten out and do your career. And he'd always threaten. I'm like, no, you know, I'm thinking... But, of course, he never did. It was just a bunch of talk.
Yeah.
Thank God.
So from high school, or when you were in high school, and again, we're just a reminder, we're talking with Candy Clark, the actress.
We are.
And in high school, did you get involved with all the drama clubs?
No, I did not. I was really an outsider. And I had a few friends. I was kind of a fringe character. You know, that was always on the edge, not too involved.
What were you into? What were you into?
Jack Daniels, you know, drinking and you know, being a hard-drinking teenager, really.
You learn from your dad.
Not that I'm proud of it, but that's what happened.
You learn from your dad on that, I guess, you know.
I guess so. But, you know, in Texas, there were a lot of teenage alcoholics at the time.
Yeah.
And liquor was not easy to get. It was, you know, at the nightclubs, you had to bring your own bottle. And they would serve setups, you know, the bars would. And there was a lot of underage kids getting into these bars. You know, back when I was a kid, you didn't have to be a certain age to buy a pack of cigarettes. Your mother or your father could send you to the grocery store if you were 5 years old, and they would sell you cigarettes.
Yeah,
that's
it
was.
Things have changed, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's all kinds of rules now.
Yeah. So how did you get into acting?
Oh, that's a really long story. How much time do we have?
I don't know. Well, give us the Reader's Digest version.
The what?
The Reader's
Digest version?
Yeah,
I was modeling in New York. I lived in New York City, and I wanted to do some extra work, you know, be an extra. And I heard you could get paid $35 a day and all the donuts and coffee you could drink. And, you know, it seemed like a really easy job. So I went to this casting office and... you know, I got an extra job right away. I was in this crowd scene of about, I don't know, 100 people in a Dustin Hoffman film called Who is Harry Kellerman and Why is He Saying Those Terrible Things About Me? A very long title, but I thought it was really neat to look at Dustin Hoffman and, you know, we just did the same thing over and over again, come through this revolving door like at the end of a work day and... You know, Dustin Hoffman would drop his musical instrument, and we would be flooding and walking around him. And you know, he had on a fuzzy wig and had a lot of orange makeup on. But when you saw the film, it looked, you know, his skin tone looked totally right. But when you saw him in person on a sunny day, it looked just totally orange-faced. So, yeah.
Someone knew what they were doing.
Guess so.
So
anyway, from extra work, I segued into acting.
What about John Huston? Not to go into too much about him, but what was it like working with a legend like John Huston?
It was fantastic. You know, when I first did the audition, I had no idea who he was, and I was really bad at the audition. And but for some reason, they said I was going to have to come back for a screen test, and I was, you know, I just wanted to be an extra. I didn't want to be at that point, I didn't want to, you know, do any memorizing or any of that. But they insisted, and so I went to the screen test, and there was Margot Kidder was also testing, and so was this other actress named Jennifer Salt, who was, her dad was Waldo Salt, and I think he was a writer. But anyway, Jeff Bridges was there, and he and I just instantly love at first sight, and he and I were together for 4 years. But
were you together when American Graffiti was being shot?
Yes. So I, you know, I did the screen test. I met Jeff Bridges. We moved in together, and we did the movie together. That was a multitude of pluses on that film. That was great.
Yeah.
John Huston was nice as he could be. He was tall and very elegant. And also, he dressed the part. Like, if you saw a movie about a director, this is how a director from Europe would dress. You know, matching everything, gabardine suits and, you know, capes, wool capes from Ireland, and, you know, like Sherlock Holmes cap that matches, and, you know, beautiful leather shoes.
Yeah.
And he smoked Dunhill cigars all day long.
Mm.
That's when you could smoke on the set and everything.
Yeah, things have changed. Certainly smoking is
That's when you could smoke on an airplane. When I think back of smoking on, you know, public transportation, my God.
Oh, never get away with it now. People would
You lit up on an airplane, but then people could, first you could light up anywhere. You know, I'd be sitting next to, you know, I'd be in the middle seat or whatever, just puffing away, and so would everyone. And then they moved everyone to the back of the plane. If you wanted to smoke, you know, and progressively they got you back to the back of the plane, and then they just, you know, said nobody can smoke anymore. But they, what is really funny, for years they still had the ashtrays in the arm of the seats.
Are you a smoker?
Not anymore, no. I quit in 1988.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's good.
I will never touch cigarettes again.
I think a lot of us would echo that. Well, let me ask you, you mentioned your relationship with Jeff Bridges. You were in a relationship, you were living with him at the time of American Graffiti?
Yeah.
Do you think the fact that you were with him kept you out of a relationship with any of the other actors there?
Well, I would hope so.
No, I'm saying, would there have been a relationship with any of them?
With, say, Richard Dreyfuss? No.
Harrison Ford?
No.
No. So there was no chemistry there.
No. No, and Charles Martin Smith? No. He played Toad.
Yeah, I know who he is.
I mean, we all got along. Nobody was, it wasn't, you know, we weren't intermingling in that way. But we all got along as friends, and that was really important. And I think that's what showed in the movie.
How about Ronnie Howard? Was he involved with a girl during the movie? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh. Oh, yes. He had his girlfriend Cheryl, who he wound up marrying, and they're still together.
That's amazing.
And she came to visit on the set, and she had red hair, and he had red hair. They look like brother and sister.
It's amazing. He was focused back then. He had his steady girlfriend he's still married to.
Yeah, and he had his film. Actually, the girl next door. Like, she really lived next door.
It's amazing.
And they've been together since.
You mentioned him being
high school.
You mentioned him being a teenager. He was probably more experienced than just about anybody, including George Lucas. On that, I mean, he had how many years of Andy Griffith
show? You know, he comes across as not a wise guy. You know, he's very apple pie. That's how I describe him.
How does that
very
happen?
Very Americana.
How does it happen with a Ron Howard and you know, maybe like a Jodie Foster, for example? I mean, who turned out as child stars to be, you know, one's an Ivy Leaguer and one's a near billionaire. You know, how does that happen? You see all of these horror stories and nightmares with the children's stars, and some of them just skate right past it. I mean, is it upbringing? What is it?
Yeah, Ron Howard had a mom and a dad and a brother, and they all lived together in, I think, Burbank. And, you know, he went to public school, and he was never treated like, you know, special. He wasn't spoiled. He didn't have high, you know, a big head about his work or any of that. He was kept very grounded. I don't know about Jodie Foster.
We are speaking with Candy Clark, actress, and certainly a little bit of a historian here, a little bit of a film historian. And, you know, we haven't touched on any of the other work, but I don't mind because we are coming into a special year of American Graffiti, and I know there's going to be some big celebrations coming up for 2013. Am I right?
Well, it'll be the 40th anniversary, which is so hard to believe that 40 years have passed because, you know, I talk about it so much and I relive it so much that it really doesn't seem that long ago, but it is. And 40 years of pleasure. It's a film I'm really proud of, and it's a film I'll be forever connected to. And I, you know, if that's my biggest thing, then, you know, biggest film and one I'm most famous for, then so be it. You know, it's a classic.
It's a classic. And, it's one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah, it's in the best 100 films of all time by the American Film Institute.
Yeah, where is it on the list?
Well, at one time it was in the 70s, and now the last time I checked, it was in the 60s. It could, you know, it could be getting closer to number one, which is, you know, my goal. I would love it to be number one.
Well, I mean, it is such an excellent film, just from start to finish. The acting, not only the work that you did and Ron Howard did, but everyone, just from start to finish.
You know, I every so often I'll do one of these hot rod shows, and they'll have a drive-in screening of American Graffiti, you know, because that really goes with the hot rods. And I'll watch the film, and it's not like I'm looking at myself. It's like I'm looking at these characters. And I've seen it over 50 times, but every time I see it, it's like seeing it for the first time. I forget where the jokes are, you know, and they always make me laugh. And, you know, I just, it's just such a, it's very PG, you know, it's very Americana, you know, there's nothing offensive about it. And but it's hilarious. It is a funny film.
In retrospect, in 2020 hindsight, we all have it. Who would have been, in your mind, at the time, who would have been your most likely to succeed out of all of those characters, acting-wise and directing-wise?
Gosh, long pause, and we don't have time for long pauses on the radio.
That's all right. We could edit.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never thought. You know, Harrison Ford would be kind of last down the list.
I imagine, right? Harrison Ford was just a bit player in that when it came.
Yeah, and also he, you know, he was kind of off-putting.
He was.
He really took his character seriously, and he was kind of that Falfa guy day and night.
What was he like? Method acting?
I have no idea, but he would, you know, glare at you. I have snapshots of him, and he's always glaring into the camera.
Yeah, like, maybe he was
like
method
acting. You have no right to take my picture.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Even then.
What about Dreyfus? What was Dreyfus like?
At that time, he was mourning the breakup of his girlfriend, and he was kind of in a depression, really.
Mm.
Spent a lot of time in his room alone.
Wolfman Jack?
Crying, I think.
Yeah, what about Wolfman Jack?
He worked one evening, I think. I never met him until way after the fact, after the film was over with.
What about Mackenzie?
And it turned out he was doing a lot of hot rod shows and county fairs, but he never let us in on that. Never told us about it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, he might have done, he might have felt that was beneath him somehow, right?
Was he not like, beneath him.
No?
No, because he was doing it.
Yeah, well, I'm saying he might have felt...
He was a big star in that world.
He might have felt that promoting it to you guys was...
Well, he really didn't know us. I mean, we had really no connection. You know, we didn't have each other's phone numbers or anything. He flew in, I guess, for the evening and did those scenes, and then he was gone. And when we didn't have to work, we certainly didn't show up for work to watch, you know, because it was there's no place to sit, and it was really cold, and... You know, we had our time off. We didn't want to go out and stay up all night watching other people do scenes.
We are with Candy Clark, actress, and we're talking primarily about American Graffiti. We've mentioned, well, I would say this, when you mention child stars, you always think about this Dana Plato and the horrible tragedy that went along with her life. But another person whose name comes up, in child stars and not, you know, certainly not tragedy, but certainly controversy and adversarial relationships with the rest of the world is Mackenzie Phillips.
Mackenzie.
Yeah, what was your impression of her?
She was great. She and I hung out all the time, and I think she was 11, but she seemed like, you know, my age. And she was one of the gang. So, only later you find out about her childhood and being, you know, with John Phillips as her father and, you know, Michelle Phillips and, you know, that lifestyle. But then she was just very, you know, feet on the ground, kind of a kid like maybe Jodie Foster would be, just a more mature than you would expect.
Precocious.
Yeah, precocious. There's the word.
There's the word.
And, you know, she was really good in the film. And
she was excellent.
She just arrived on the set. She was 11. And she wound up having to stay with one of the producers, Gary Kurtz. Because she just, you know, they just put her on a plane, and 11-year-old, and here I am. You know, she had no guardian or anything.
Yeah, laws are different now. You'd have to have one of the parents or have a legal guardian.
Oh, you have to have a guardian.
Yeah.
But then, you know, her parents were, you know, hippies.
Yeah. Wait, were you partying with her? I mean, was it like the type of thing where she was drinking or smoking or doing anything around the set?
I don't think she was a smoker then. And I never offered her a drink.
Yeah, so. No. But I'm saying, was she, you know, did you see her partying?
No, she's just hanging out, working, you know.
Not
difficult. 11, so
yeah.
That might have been before she got so entrapped in that lifestyle.
Yeah, it's.
I think when she did One Day at a Time and those films, I mean, that series, she was a lot older. She might have been in her 20s at that point.
How many of the folks from the movie do you keep in touch with on a regular basis?
Paula Matt, Bo Hopkins, Cindy Williams, Mackenzie. Every so often I'll call Charlie. He hasn't done any hot rod shows. He lives in Canada, and yeah. He's been up there for years.
Nobody's died from that original cast, am I right?
Manny Padilla.
Oh, Manny
There's a few people who have died, but not the main character.
Who's Manny Padilla? What did he
play? Played one of the Pharaohs.
Okay.
He was the little Hispanic guy, but, you know, he was doing a lot of hot rod shows with us.
Did he reenact his, I mean, did he recreate his role sort of for Happy Days? Did he do a...
He might have been in Happy Days. Yeah, I think he was.
One of the early episodes.
He was a good friend of Ron Howard, so I think Ronnie hired him for, you know, quite a few things.
Yeah. Now, when you saw Happy Days emerge, what was your thought? Were you thinking about work on there, or were you just thinking big screen?
No, at that time I was a movie snob, and I didn't want to do TV.
Yeah. Did they approach you about it?
No. And I had tuned out of TV. I don't even think I've seen one episode of Happy Days.
Yeah, the early episodes were absolutely great. I mean, they were very, very good, you know, almost like a movie. You know, the first
I think that was Gary Marshall.
Yeah, Gary Marshall was excellent. Did you work with Gary over the years?
He wanted me to be in. he was going to do a series called Alan the Pussycat. Mm-hmm. And I went with my manager to meet him at his office. And then I proceeded to say, you know, I really don't want to do TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's stupid. You know.
Oh, hey, listen. You know, you live and learn. You live and learn.
I know. Now, I wish I had started in TV. I would have a big TV queue, and, you know, I'd still be working in television.
Well, living and learning is a big part of
well,
it.
Well, sometimes you learn too late, and the opportunities are behind you.
Yeah. Actress Candy Clark is our special guest today on Turning Point.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Actress Candy Clark is our special guest today on Turning Point. Candy Clark, I was going to say best known for American Graffiti, but that's not.
Oh,
you,
yeah.
You have
yeah.
a body of work. You really have a body of work that's tremendous. And over 50 films is a wonderful career.
It is.
And let me ask you about some of the roles that you passed on, and I hate to rub it in.
Passed on?
Yeah.
There haven't been many that I've passed on.
Well, that's recently, but what about in the past? You passed on Alan the Pussycats, right?
That was going to be a TV series.
Yeah, well, what about TV? What did you pass on TV?
Good grief, I don't remember. We're talking, you know, a long time ago. These are not things I'm focusing on.
When was the last time you spoke to George Lucas?
I don't know. Years.
When you were hired for American Graffiti, what were the expectations? What did you think? This is going to be a nice little movie, or this is...
Oh, I thought it was a great script. And I thought, you know, it was exactly what we were doing in Fort Worth, Texas. Cruising, looking for, you know, action, drinking, smoking, you know, listening to Wolfman Jack.
Were you listening to Wolfman Jack in...
Yes.
Did he have... He still had shows. He had shows
yes,
going on.
Yes, he was broadcasting out of Mexico, I think. Had a huge tower. And, you know, there were all kinds of theories as to who he was, just like in the movie.
That's interesting. That's actually a great scene when he's seen talking through the crack. That was Richard Dreyfuss, right? Who looks in and sees him and puts on his Wolfman voice. That was actually a very good, very good little scene, and it says a lot. It says a lot more than what you would.
It
just
says think. A lot about the mystique of Wolfman. Nobody knew who he was or what he looked like.
Well,
there are all kinds of theories.
I certainly think we all know what the turning point in your career was. What was the turning point in your life?
The turning point was when I left Fort Worth, Texas. I was going to go, well, it's a long story, but my friend Judy and I, we were working at the Apparel Mart. I think I had graduated high school. And the Apparel Mart is where all these vendors come in from New York City or around the country, and they show their clothing in these little booths. And my friend Judy and I got hired as models, the certain vendor would have some clients there wanting to buy for their department store or whatever, and Judy and I would quickly go backstage, change clothes, and come out with the items, you know. And that's how they got orders for stuff. Anyway, so the guy that had the booth, his name was Peter Callis. I'll never forget his name. And Judy and I were like 19. And he said, yeah, if you're ever in New York, look me up. And he gave us a card. And that was, you know, that's the last thing you want to say to a couple of teenagers that want to escape.
Yeah.
You know, the small town and go to the big city. So I was going to, I bought my youth fare ticket, which was $40, I think, round trip on TWA. They had like a summer special. And, you know, Judy and I were going to go together. And she totally disappeared. And I couldn't find her. And I called and called and called. And then I thought, well, you know, I've got my ticket. I'm going. So I took the midnight flight. Might have been the 1 a.m. flight, I don't know, but the red eye. And as we were starting to come into New York City, I saw New York City from the air, and it had the sunrise light hitting it. It was all kind of pink and gold.
Wow.
And I was looking out the window. I had the window seat, and I'm looking out the window, and I thought, I'm never going back to Fort Worth, Texas. And I kind of moved into New York City from the air, really.
Yeah.
And I remember I was had my little bag, and I was walking the streets in New York City like, you know, Joe Buck from Midnight Cowboy.
I was just going to say.
Yeah. I'm looking up at all the tall buildings. And I finally find, you know, it was a confusing city, but I loved it. I loved it immediately. I loved it from the air. And that's my turning point.
How
and
about
then
yeah, go
from
ahead.
New York City, I got into modeling, and from modeling, I got into acting.
How about the audition for American Graffiti? What do you remember about it?
There was really no audition. You just met with George. And at that time, I was very desperate to get a job. And so I thought, this time I'm going to dress up as I was told. I hadn't read the script. I was told that it took place in the 50s. So I had on a blue jeans rolled up and some saddle Oxford shoes and a Letterman sweater. You know, I found an old Letterman sweater, and I put a high school ring on a chain and pulled my hair back in a ponytail. And I'm sitting in the lobby. You know, and there's all these other actors there, and I'm the only one dressed up. I felt like such an idiot. But I go in to this tiny, tiny little office, and basically there was just a room for a desk. There was George Lucas sitting behind the desk, and then there's me standing in front of the desk, and then there's the wall behind me. I mean, it was small. It was like a cubicle. It was like a closet, really. And he didn't say anything to me. I was just kind of, you know, I knew that I had struck out, and I called my manager when I left, and I said, well, I blew it again, and, you know, I told her I dressed up for the part, and I guess that was a no-no, and, you know. So a few weeks later, I'd gotten a hold of the script, and I had said, Pat, you've got to get me in on this movie. And she said, well, you've met George Lucas. He didn't respond, and, you know, I can't get you back in. So I kept bugging her, and I said, I've got to get back in. And I go back. She finally gives me back in, and I go back in, and I don't mention, you know, I'm just dressed as myself. I don't mention anything about being there before or remember me. I was the one in costume, nothing. And the next thing I know, they're asking me to do a screen test. So it wasn't as glamorous as you would imagine. There were about 200 actors over at Dove Film. And, you know, it's very intimidating. And you could see everyone doing their screen tests. And there were all kinds of TV stars there. And I remember Judy Strangis was there, and she was like the star of Room 222. And I had this one little scene memorized, and I, my name finally gets called, and I go in and to this kind of alcove area, and they have a park bench, and Toad's there. I meet him. He's really, really short. Charles Martin Smith is short. He's about 5'4", and I'm 5'7", and I think, well, there goes that, you know, we're nowhere close in height. And I do this scene where Toad's telling me I look like Connie Stevens, and I basically gave up, and I'm just kind of, you know, saying the lines, and I had no hope for it. I was just going through the motions, and lo and behold, I got the part. And George Lucas was videotaping it, and he had this it looked like a pink plastic video camera, like the cheapest model you could ever buy. And later, years later, I said, George, whatever happened to my screen test? I'd really like to see it. And he said, well, it came out black. And I'm black? Oh, well, why'd you hire me? And he said, well, I liked what I saw through the viewfinder. So that's how I got hired. It was just all basically, you know, an accident.
Did he have any idea that you were there on your second go around?
No, he never mentioned it, and I certainly wasn't going to mention it. No.
So that's the way to go. I mean, that's perseverance. You just switched your look. He's probably seen hundreds of girls at that point.
I figured he's not going to recognize me.
Is the role you ultimately got the one that you read for originally?
Yeah, that was the one I read for.
You didn't even think about Cindy Williams' role, right?
No. In fact, I thought my character was the best character.
Yeah, I think a lot of people agree with you. The Academy agreed with you.
Yeah, and, you know, the makeup lady and I kind of, and the wardrobe people, we kind of designed the character. And the makeup hair lady is the one that said, you know, if you have really light blonde hair, you'll really show up. So we found this wig, because my hair is so straight, and it wouldn't hold a curl. It wouldn't have, you know, because you had to have that look, the flip, and all that teased big hair. And so we found this great wig that was really too small for me, and it was all cut. We had to split it up the back and then kind of artfully smudge the hair around so it would cover the split. And it was kind of like a child-sized wig, really. And the hairdresser said it was made out of yak's hair. Mm. That's why it held such a curl. I'm like, wow, yak's hair, yeah. But she, you know, she's the pro. She would know.
Who's got the wig? Do you have it in a special place or are you?
No. It went back to the rental place. Mm. The wig went rental place, and we found it again because we did more American Graffiti. And yep. I said, well, it was at a rental place in the valley, and so they remembered. They go, oh, yeah, that's the blah, blah, you know, wig rental place. It was kind of out of someone's private home, but they had a rental thing, you know.
We're speaking with our special guest, Candy Clark, today. Actually, it's fascinating, not only for people that are into American Graffiti, but people that are into, you know, acting in general. I mean, you're giving us a real insight here. More American Graffiti. Was that a big payday for you guys?
Well, not compared to today's payday.
No, but still, for the time.
But it was really nice to get. And, you know, my character wound up in Haight-Ashbury, and that was certainly fun. And I was working with Mackenzie Phillips again. And, you know, when I was living in New York back in the 70s, you would read about Haight-Ashbury and all the fun that was being had. And I always wanted to, you know, be there, but I kind of got to be there, you know. We were recreating Haight-Ashbury, and that was fun. It was with, you know, a lot of the familiar people we'd already worked with, you know, in the first film, but the story was a little too serious. You know, I think people wanted to see more, like kind of just pick up where we left off in the first Graffiti and just have, you know, more American Graffiti, but it got all serious about Haight-Ashbury and demonstrations and civil rights and Vietnam War, and some of your characters got killed, and, you know.
Toad got killed, right? Well, Milner got one of those two. Oh, no, Toad got killed in it.
Toad did not get killed. He was missing in action.
Missing, right, there you go.
Yeah, he took off in the jungles of Vietnam.
Who directed?
Bo Hopkins, the leader of the Pharaohs, got killed in the helicopter.
Now, who directed More American Graffiti?
A guy named Bill Norton. Bill Norton.
I guess Lucas wanted nothing to do with it?
Oh, you know, he never really liked directing.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. What are you planning on doing for the 40th? I don't mean just you, but I mean, is there a big celebration plan?
So far, nothing by Universal Pictures.
How is that possible? How is that possible?
Nothing. Well, you know, they've gone forward. I'm kind of back here stuck in time in graffiti land.
Yeah. Well, still 40.
But, you know, they've had, you know, maybe someone needs to call them and say, hey, do you realize, you know, the 40th anniversary is coming up?
I imagine.
What are you going to do?
I imagine the media, if nothing else. What was the month that you guys filmed in 73?
It was like in June.
June of 73?
Yes.
And it was released when?
72.
Oh, okay, 72. So it was released in 73.
Yes, it was.
And you remember when it was released?
I do. It was at the Avco Cinema here in Westwood. And they had the cars there, the hot rod cars. And they parked them a few blocks away, and that's where we had to meet. And then we got in the cars from the movie, and then they drove us over to the front of the theater. And then we walked in.
That's amazing.
That was pretty special.
It's an amazing story of a fantastic film, and we're with a fantastic actress. Candy Clark, what would you like to add? Any website?
Oh, I don't know. I'm kind of running out of steam.
Plug something. What do you got?
I have nothing. You know, I do a lot of hot rod shows, and I, you know, I like working with my hands. I have a house from the 30s that I'm always constantly painting or doing something to. I have a garden, a vegetable garden that I'm always digging around in, and I got a cat named Betty, and, you know, I have a very good life. My health is good. You know, things are great.
And what was the last acting you've done?
The last thing I did was Criminal Minds, and that was in May, I think it was.
Very good.
It was the season finale.
Sounds like you're doing great, though. It sounds like you're enjoying
it. Good. I have a lot of hot rod shows lined up so far for next year. And
you don't have candyclark.com or something along those lines?
No.
Oh, wow.
No, I have a Facebook page, and it's really me on the Facebook page.
Oh, that's interesting. So
and
people
respond.
People can get in touch with you through Facebook then.
Yes, I'm pretty well topped out with friends, but, you know, I've met their limits. But now they've added something called subscribers, which I have no idea what that is. But I guess you can tune in and make a comment or look at the page. I don't know what a subscriber really gets you, but... You know, I really enjoy Facebook, and I have gotten work from it.
That's terrific.
Yeah. It's a good, valuable tool.
Candy Clark from American Graffiti fame and all types of other films, more than 50 films. Candy, thanks for being here.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening.
Yay!
And keep an eye out for Candy around the 40th anniversary. You'll be seeing and hearing a lot about her, I'm sure. She's wonderful. And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week, and we'll hear you next week on Turning Point.
Turning Point with Frank McKay is brought to you by Herman, Katz, Congemi, and Klein, Duffy & Duffy, Gold Coast Bank, Heartland Business Center, Morgan Stanley and Smith Barney of PC Wealth Management, and the Hagedorn Little Village School in Seaford, New York. Turning Point with Frank McKay was produced by GVP Digital Media in Ronkonkoma, New York. Executive producers Frank McKay and Harry Oates. Associate producers Kristen and John McKay. Audio and studio engineering Brittany Fergo and Francis Kazmarek. Hotel and accommodations provided by Ohika Castle Hotel and Estates in Huntington, New York. Transportation services provided by Mark of Elegance Limousine in Hop Hog, New York. Catering services provided by Chella Bagels of Selden, New York.